This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Patricia Volk, knew she could never measure up to her mother's good looks when she was growing up in the 50s. Beauty and being beautiful was very important to Volk's mother. But Patricia found an alternative way of thinking about fashion and beauty from a memoir in her mother's book collection, Shocking Life by the fashion designer Elsa Schiaparelli. It was Schiaparelli's surrealist-influenced fashion and her personality that got the attention, not her face. Volk has written a memoir contrasting what she learned from her mother's conventional sense of beauty and being a woman with that of Schiaparelli. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, said the book, quote, breaks new ground in terms of the memoir form and also the archetypal story of the mother-daughter bond, unquote. Volk's previous book, Stuffed, was about growing up in a Manhattan restaurant family. She spoke with Terry last Tuesday.
Patricia Volk, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to start with a reading from your memoir, Shocked. And I think a lot of daughters will relate to this.
What do you do when you're little and you know you can't be like your mother? I adore and am proud of my mother, but what she wants from me is blind adherence to the mystifying virtue of seemly behavior. Why must I sit with my ankles crossed? Why does she pinch my cheeks with rouge on her fingertips as I leave the apartment? Why are her parting words, "Don't be loud"? In a race with a boy, I have to let him win? Why does she care so much about how I look? When I get home from a party, her first question is, "Were you the prettiest girl there?" Is there a way to answer that that doesn't make you cringe? You don't agree with what your mother thinks is important. You don't want to care what she thinks. At the very least, you'd rather care less. Your older sister tries to be like her. You watch. Over and over, your sister fails. You want to be you, whatever that is, not your mother's idea of you. You don't know what it takes, how much of it is luck. You suspect you're going to be all right in the world. You hope you are. You yearn for a signal. You're ripe for it. Sometimes it comes from a teacher or a relative. It could be a situation that shows you something about yourself you didn't know. Sometimes it's a book. There is a coincidence. I have no idea what it means. My mother wears Shocking Perfume by Elsa Schiaparelli, and the book that diffuses her, the book that transforms me, is Shocking Life by Elsa Schiaparelli.
That's Patricia Volk reading from her new memoir, Shocked, My Mother, Schiaparelli, and Me. Do you know, I was almost angry reading that your mother asked you if you were the prettiest girl at the party. like you said, there's no answer you can give without cringing. What did you say when she would ask you that?
I would just kind of shrug. Most of the time I said, no, Mom, I wasn't. Bobby Finkelstein was there, and she's much prettier than I am. You know, but I would never say I was the prettiest girl there. It seemed vain and wrong. But I believe that when my mother went to parties, she looked around the room and felt she was the prettiest girl there.
So
I hated the question.
You hated it when your mother asked you that?
I hated it. It was like, you know, she didn't ask me if I had a good time. She didn't ask me if a boy asked me to dance. It was as if the only thing that was important was that I was the prettiest girl there. I didn't care about that.
And the other thing is, you weren't beautiful by your report. It's not like I saw what you looked like, but but still, you're born looking how you look, and sure, you can put on makeup and have nice clothes and stuff, but in terms of like that idealized sense of beauty, either you have it or you don't, and to be constantly expected to measure up to an ideal of beauty that you're just never going to have just seems so almost cruel.
Well, I was never going to have it. I looked like my father, although I think I was rather attractive, but in a very different way than my mother, who was glamorous and a movie star. She had a movie star kind of look. She was always compared to, people actually took sides. There was the Lana Turner camp and the Grace Kelly camp. She had an icy blonde beauty, an imperious kind of beauty, and that wasn't something that even appealed to me for myself, although I did bask in her glow. When people stopped me on the street and said, "Little girl, your mother's so beautiful," or the shoe salesman would say, "Do you know you have a very gorgeous mother?" If I were a dog, I would have been wagging my tail. I was just so happy for her. It was important to her. And it kind of rubbed off on me. But I didn't ever think I want to be beautiful like my mother.
What did your mother do to achieve her beauty in addition to just having a naturally beautiful face?
Well, she did have a naturally beautiful face, and it was very symmetrical, which helped. But she had an elaborate maquillage, and when I was a little girl, I loved watching her put on her makeup. I loved it, and it also disturbed me because it masked her face. By the time she was finished with all these layers of paint, she had actually put a mask of her face on top of her face. She would put on so much Max Factor pancake makeup, which she sometimes called her base, that really her face was all even like the skating rink at Rockefeller Center. It was just this flat plane. And then she'd sculpt cheekbones in with some, what she called rouge. I guess they now call it blush. And then she'd put eyes back on with blue eyeshadow and mascara, and the whole thing took a long time, and she always wore this green velvet robe that I loved. And her vanity was entirely made of mirror. Even the wastebasket that came with it was made of mirror, and the stool that she sat on. And when she finished, her final act after all this makeup went on was to dab behind her ears using Elsa Schiaparelli's shocking perfume.
And so your mother had Elsa Schiaparelli's perfume Shocking, and your mother had her memoir, which you read and you found transformative. How would you compare Elsa Schiaparelli, the famous fashion designer, how would you compare her sense of beauty with your mother's sense of beauty?
Well, Elsa Schiaparelli was quite different from my mother in terms of beauty. She was born with moles, raised black moles all over her face. She never had them removed. She had an older sister who was quite beautiful. She was said to look like the statue of Athena in the Vatican. But Elsa Schiaparelli's mother always told her she was ugly. And she didn't feel good about herself until her uncle, who was the foremost astronomer in the world at the time, Giovanni Schiaparelli, and he was the head of the La Brera Observatory in Milan. And he took his little niece to the observatory, and he asked her to look in the telescope. And what she saw was the Big Dipper, and he said, "That's what's on your face." And from then on, she felt quite attractive. She had a brooch made by Cartier that echoed the moles on her face, and she wore it under the moles. It became a source of pride for her that this constellation was on her cheek. But she believed in a kind of hard chic, very dramatic, that my mother would not have ascribed to. Elsa Schiaparelli wore notice-me clothes, fabulous notice-me clothes, and my mother was much more demure. She revealed her body, but it was covered up. Elsa Schiaparelli invented see-through clothes, and she didn't mind wearing them. Although she said she was very shy, she would wear anything.
Well, you know, in describing the difference between your mother's sense of beauty and designer Elsa Schiaparelli's sense of beauty, you say that Schiaparelli wore clothes as theater, and it wasn't about making you more beautiful. You say whether you are beautiful or not, when you enter a room wearing something designed by Elsa Schiaparelli, your clothes are the star. An unattractive woman and a beautiful woman become for a moment equals.
Yes.
So did you aspire to be that kind of clothing as theater person, or was the Schiaparelli approach just a good counterpoint to your mother, making it seem like there were alternatives, that you didn't have to follow your mother's sense of beauty or clothing?
Schiaparelli gave me an alternative way to be. I don't really wear notice-me clothes, but I do dress in a way that is something that pleases me. I don't know how other people react to it. I went through a vintage period that my mother was horrified by. She thought I was going to get bed bugs and lice and things. But I loved those old drippy clothes. And I think I still do. I dress a little bit like a female Oscar Wilde. I just love those high collars and those lavish ties at the neck. There's just something wonderful about it. I think I'll just always do that. And I do like surrealism in my clothes. For instance, I make my buttons out of the kind of faux sushi you see in the windows of Japanese takeout places. Sometimes I use dice. I like to amuse myself with my clothes, and I don't really care if anybody else likes them. I made myself a pair of earrings out of typewriter keys. That's one of my favorite things. I love getting dressed, and I just do it for myself.
You have an earlier memoir called Stuffed, and it's about growing up in a restaurant family. And your family owned a restaurant on West 38th Street in Manhattan in the Garment Center, in the area where the fashion industry and the schmata business was. So I want you to describe your family restaurant.
Well, I think it sat around 300 people. The walls were wood paneled. It was the center of the Garment Center. It's where all the buyers and the manufacturers came with gorgeous models on their arms and big cigars. At lunch, my mother manned the velvet rope, and she was always dressed to the nines. And the food was terrific. The menu was what was then called continental, which means it had dishes from all over the world. A chef wasn't known for a single specialty then. He was known for his ability to have a broad menu, like Islander shrimp luau and duck à l'orange. He'd have to cook gedämpte Rinderbrust with that. And the people loved the food. And they loved the ambiance. My father set a hard party rhythm. And he was on his feet, and he knew all his customers, and he had a joke for them. And he was kind of the touch shore of the Garment Center. And there was my beautiful mother working the line. And she was an expert at getting people up from the table so she could have another seating.
What was your mother's trick to getting people up out of the table so that she could get another seating?
She'd come over to the table with an armload of menus and say, "Did you enjoy your lunch?" And then she'd whisk their coffee cup away. Or she'd say, "Thank you so much for coming. How did you enjoy your dessert?" You know, and then the coffee cup would disappear. And she'd say, "Gus, bring the check over to 9. And, you know, suddenly people found themselves standing up.
So I think it was your great uncle who brought pastrami to America?
Actually, that was my great-grandfather, Sussman Volk. My father was called Cecil, but his real name was Sussman. And Sussman Volk came to the Lower East Side in 1887, and he had been a miller in Vilna, but New York didn't need millers at that time. So he became a tinker, and he walked around with pots and pans and on his back and sharpened knives, and he felt that the life lacked dignity. He was a very religious man. So being a religious man, being an Orthodox Jew, he knew how to butcher meat, and he opened a tiny, tiny butcher store at 88 and a half Delancey Street. And one day a man came in from Romania and asked if he could store a trunk in the basement. He was actually going back to Romania. He must have been the only refugee who went back. But he was going back, and Reb Sussel, as he was called, because he was a religious man, said, "Yes, you can store your trunk in my basement, but what will you give me?" And the man said, "I'll give you the recipe for pastrami." So my great-grandfather started curing pastrami, and then people wanted it on a slice of bread. And then he put chairs and tables in, and suddenly it was a delicatessen. And after school, all his five children came into the store and made toodles, which were little cones of wax paper with a dollop of mustard in them that people could squeeze onto their sandwiches. He was the first pastrami vendor in New York. The following year, Katz's opened, but Sussman Volk's was the first delicatessen.
So your parents were well-known for their restaurant. You had an uncle who was well-known as a demolition man. He knocked down how many buildings in his career?
Oh, my God, hundreds. Jacob Volk was my paternal grandfather. He invented the wrecking ball.
He invented the wrecking ball?
Yeah. And he invented the upside-down method of house wrecking, which was knocking the roof out and then taking the building down inside with these huge, huge sort of tubes and having trucks lined up that he would fill. They'd go directly into the truck. And he was a Jew, and Jews were not welcome in demolition and shoring at the time he went into it, which was in the early 1900s. But he broke into the business by saying, "I will pay you for the right to tear down your building." And then he resold all the pieces. And he had Klondikers, men who would chip old cement off bricks for 5 cents a brick. He resold every brick. Eventually, he did get paid for taking down buildings because he was so good at it. And he had time clauses in his contracts. And if he tore the buildings down before the date that they were supposed to come down, he'd get a huge bonus at that time. He was a very rich man. He won the land for his house that he built in Bensonhurst in a card game with Jimmy Walker. He was a high liver, big drinker, and a fair man. He paid his men every week on time and what they were promised, but he kept a blackjack on his desk and a bottle of liquor, and he gave them the money and a shot, and they looked at the blackjack and they were happy.
Patricia Volk, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Patricia Volk speaking with Terry Gross last Tuesday. Her new memoir is called Shocked. Her earlier memoir about her restaurant family is called Stuffed. Coming up, Claire Massoud tells us about her new novel, The Woman Upstairs. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Being a single woman doesn't have the stigma it once did. A single woman is no longer called a spinster. But even so, being single with no children is not the life that Nora Eldridge imagined for herself. Nora is the main character in the new novel, The Woman Upstairs, by our next guest, Claire Massoud. Nora wanted to be an artist and mother, not a third-grade elementary school teacher. The novel, in part, is about the dark side of what it really means to sacrifice everything for your art. Massoud also is the author of the bestseller The Emperor's Children. She lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where her new novel is set, and spoke with Terry last Thursday.
Claire Massoud, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start with a reading from The Woman Upstairs, and you're welcome to just start reading or to set it up for us in any way you'd like.
Thank you, Terry, for having me. I guess I'll just start reading. And this is somebody named Nora Eldridge, who is an elementary school teacher. How angry am I? You don't want to know. Nobody wants to know about that. I'm a good girl, I'm a nice girl, I'm a straight-A, straight-laced, good daughter, good career girl, and I never stole anybody's boyfriend, and I never ran out on a girlfriend, and I put up with my parents' and my brother's, and I'm not a girl anyhow, I'm over 40 years old, and I'm good at my job, and I'm great with kids, and I held my mother's hand when she died, after 4 years of holding her hand while she was dying, and I speak to my father every day on the telephone, every day, mind you, and what kind of weather do you have on your side of the river, because here it's pretty gray and a bit muggy, too. It was supposed to say great artist on my tombstone, but if I died right now, it would say such a good teacher, daughter, friend instead. And what I really want to shout and want in big letters on that grave, too, is F*** you all.
Thank you for reading it. It's a very angry opening of Claire Massoud's new novel, The Woman Upstairs. So, you wanted to write a novel from a woman's point of view where the woman was being fueled by anger. Why?
Well, that's part of what I wanted to do, although not all. I think as a reader, since very early, I have found myself drawn to rants. I was in my senior year of high school when I read Notes from Underground by Dostoevsky, and it was an exhilarating discovery. I hadn't known up till that moment that fiction could be like that, that fiction could say these things, could be unseemly, could be unsettling and distressing in that particular way, that immediate and urgent way. And in the many years since, I have read and loved a number of ranting narrators, and it struck me eventually that they were all men, and that I didn't know of a book in which a woman expressed her anger, and I thought perhaps I should write one.
The main character in your novel is a single woman who thinks of herself as the woman upstairs, or rather, she thinks other people think of her as the woman upstairs. She is a woman who's always dreamed of being an artist and having children. Having a husband was negotiable in her mind, but the art and the children were not. And she ends up in her early 40s still being single. She's a third grade teacher. She does some art, but she doesn't think of herself as an artist. So her ambition, her fantasy has really been thwarted. It's not like she has a miserable life or anything, but it's not the life she wanted. And I'm thinking, like, you are an artist, like you are a writer, you have that life, and you have a husband and children. So again, I'm interested in this idea of somebody wanting a life similar to yours, but But being thwarted in getting it.
Well, I think all of us are thwarted in some ways, some more than others. I happen to be very fortunate in being able to, I always wanted to write, and so far I'm able to do that. And I'm very lucky, but I'm mindful of the fact that that is a rare good fortune. And I think there are many different experiences. There are people who never had a particular ambition and have discovered a happy life or an unhappy life without having had a trajectory they dreamed of. But for many of us, we set out thinking there will be time in the future, and then suddenly we find ourselves at a moment when we have to acknowledge that the future isn't infinite. In our culture, we're able to remain young or to think of ourselves as young for a very long time. And so we can get well into our 30s thinking that the future is all ahead of us. And there comes a realization at some point that it isn't. And that's a realization that happens for people who are doing what they want to do as much as for people who haven't been able to.
Part of a novel is about how selfish and self-absorbed do you have to be in order to be an artist? And what license does being an artist give you to be selfish and self-absorbed? Because if your art comes first, what are you sacrificing for your art? Other people? Your relationship with them? What was it like for you when figuring out what balance you wanted in your life between doing your art, writing fiction, and you know, your commitment to your husband and your children and your parents?
Right. I don't think it's ever figured out. I think it's a balance that anyone is negotiating and renegotiating throughout a life. I certainly felt when I was a teenager and wanted to write, looking at the women writers who had come before, I felt that obviously one should not marry. Obviously one could not have children. Ideally one would be gay. And then you'd have a woman partner who would fully understand the situation. Then the generation, actually pretty much my mother's generation, and afterwards, suddenly there were women writers with children, with families. And it seemed maybe it is possible. Why not? But part of what the book is about for me is, yes, absolutely, this question of how you, particularly for women, the choices that are necessary to make art, which are choices to make something that doesn't exist that nobody needs. So how...
when you put it that way.
but it's true. People might be glad you made it once you made it, but before you made it, it doesn't exist. And what's the point? And so you really do have to... There is some selfishness that's required. And if you have been acculturated to care for other people, to put other people's needs first, how do you take that step? How do you carve out a space for yourself? And that's something that Nora hasn't managed to do, and that Serena somehow has.
So again, Nora, the main character in your novel, she wants to be an artist. That was her fantasy, her dream, and has been frustrated by being a teacher. She does it very well. It's not like she doesn't like teaching, but it's not the fantasy that she always had, the life she always wanted. When did you know you wanted to write?
Oh, I can't remember not knowing. I think as soon as I understood as a child that somebody made up stories. As soon as I understood that was a thing you could do, I wanted to do that.
So that's what it was at first, storytelling that you wanted to do?
Mm-hmm. I mean, my parents gave me a typewriter for my 6th birthday because I had already announced that I was going to be a writer. So that's the family lore anyway, you know? I mean, and I had the typewriter. But I don't remember.
Who taught you to type?
Oh, I taught myself much later. They didn't teach it in school at that time. Now they do.
Oh, and like your mother didn't teach you?
No, my mother said never learn to type.
Right, because then you'll be a typist.
Exactly. Then you'll be a secretary. No woman should learn to type.
Right. So you taught yourself to type. Do you know how to type quickly now? Like, do you... Because you have... I'm sure you're at the keyboard all the time. Are you good at...
No, I write by hand. I write by hand.
You write by hand?
I do.
And then on the keyboard or only by hand?
Yes.
And then
no, I then, you know, type it into the computer, but...
Only when you have the draft that you're happy with?
No, I revise a fair amount as I go along, but then I type it in and then I print it out and revise again. I write other things on the computer, but I don't write fiction.
Do you know why?
Well, in part because I do type fast. I'm a very good secretary, in fact. And you know, it looks pretty good, typewritten, even if it's garbage. So the combination of typing fast and having it look good and be garbage means that means it's better to write by hand for me.
But the thing with writing by hand, I know when I try to write something by hand, it's so messy. I know that you're saying, like, it looking good in print is a liability, but for me, it's a way bigger liability to have this scrawl that I can barely read that's crossed out and written over, and I have no idea what I've even written after a while. It's so, It just becomes useless to me. And I'm not writing great fiction. I'm just, whatever it is, you know, I'm writing, say, an intro or a talk or something, but it's just so unusably messy.
You know, for me, it's probably a sight of some particular set of, you know, of insanity or neurosis or something, but I write very small. I write very neatly. I write on graph paper.
You write on graph paper?
I write on graph paper. I make my edits with, you know, funny little symbols, you know.
Like publishers use?
On the back of the page. No, like little, you know, asterisks and dots and, you know, stars and, you know, whatever. I guess an asterisk and a star are the same thing. But little symbols that, you know, and then I have little boxes that are, you know, on the back of the page that I know where I see the asterisk that's supposed to go in, you know.
Did you start doing this when you were a child and you knew you wanted to write?
Long ago, yeah. Yeah.
And so you started this as a child and never gave it up?
I write on a certain kind of pad. I write with a certain kind of pen, whole nine yards.
Now, your husband, James Wood, is a book critic. He's a literary critic who used to write for The New Republic and now for The New Yorker. Is it hard to be married to somebody who's a critic whose job is to be really honest about writing? I mean, sometimes you don't really want honesty. You just want somebody to say, that's really wonderful.
Right. Well, I always joke it's hard for him. It's not hard for me. I want him to be honest and say it's
and
really
to love
wonderful.
It. Yes, exactly.
Right? It's not hard for me. My demands are very simple. It falls to him to kind of figure that, square that circle. But in fact, you know, he's my first reader and we know each other very well. And unless he thinks something is disastrous, in the first instance, he's encouraging and vague, you know, keep at it. Keep going. And then when there's a draft and it's possible to be a more critical reader in a productive way, then he will be. But if I show him 20 pages, he won't start doing line edits or, you know, say, this character needs more development on page 4. You know, he won't do that. He'll just say, keep going. That's great.
But he will do that later on.
But he will do that later on. He's well trained.
So you are so lucky in that you and your husband are both successful writers. It's very hard to become a successful writer. Was it a good thing for your relationship that you were both able to succeed as writers? Because sometimes in a relationship, like, one person's more successful than the other, or one person, like, fulfills their professional dream and the other person doesn't. And, you know, that could create for some inequality or resentment within the relationship. Was it good to both, to some extent, you know, achieve what you wanted to? Sounds like you're laughing.
I'm just reminded my father had an expression that always made us laugh. He would say, "It is better to be rich and healthy than poor and sick." is it better for two people to be successful and happy than unsuccessful and miserable? I suppose it seems doesn't seem an arguable point, really. So, of course, you know, it's a wonderful blessing that we're both able to do the things that we care most about and love doing. And a particular gift for me to share my life with somebody who cares so much about so many of the same things that I do. What it would be like in a different circumstance, I honestly don't know.
Well, Claire Massoud, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Claire Massoud speaking with Terry Gross last Thursday. Massoud's new novel is called The Woman Upstairs. Coming up, Martin Scorsese talks about film and film history. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David B. Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Martin Scorsese is a great director, but he can also be a great film teacher. We're going to hear him talk about the early days of cinema. One of the earliest film directors, George Méliès, was the inspiration for the Scorsese film Hugo. We're happy to be able to present an excerpt from Scorsese's talk last month when he gave the National Endowment for the Humanities 42nd Annual Jefferson Lecture at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. He started his talk with a clip from the film The Magic Box, which was made in 1950. When Scorsese saw it in 1952, it made a lasting impression on him. It's based on the story of William Freeze Greene, who invented the movie camera, and stars Robert Donat. In this scene, Freeze Greene has just projected moving images of London's Hyde Park for a man who's never seen a moving picture before and is astonished by what he's just witnessed.
Where's it come from? And where's it gone to?
It's all here. Here, look. That's where the Hyde Park you saw is. Like a magic lantern.
But it moved.
Yes, it moved, didn't it? Now look. Look at this strip of celluloid film. It's taken me years to get to that. Years. That's the secret. Dozens of snapshots of Hyde Park. Only in one picture, the carriage is here, the next is here, the next is here, the next is here, and so on. Now look at the mechanism. You see, the film, that's what it's called, comes from this spool over these rollers. That's the tension. You've got to have tension onto this second spool down here. Now look in the middle. It's a bit like a magic lantern, but instead of one picture at a time, you see eight or more pictures every second. And that's what you see on that sheet there. Eight pictures every second, and they all merge together into one moving, living picture. See? Of course, there's a bit more to it than that. I'm not saying it's perfect. Far from it. But it works. God be praised, it works, doesn't it? You can see that.
Thank you. This scene is from a picture called The Magic Box, which was made in England in 1950. And the great English actor Robert Donat plays the inventor William Freeze Greene. He was one of the people who invented movies. I saw this picture for the first time with my father. I was 8 years old, and I have never really gotten over the impact that it had. And I believe this is what ignited in me the wonder of cinema and the obsession, watching movies, making them, inventing them. Freeze Greene gives everything of himself to the movies, and he dies poor. He dies a pauper. That line, "You must be a very happy man, Mr. Freeze Greene," of course, is ironic, knowing the full story of his life. But in some ways, it's also true because he's followed his obsession all the way. So it's both disturbing and inspiring. Now, my parents had a good reason for taking me to the movies all the time, because I was always sick with asthma since I was 3 years old. And I apparently couldn't do any sports, so that's what they told me. But really, my mother and father did love the movies. They weren't in the habit of reading. That didn't really exist where I came from. And so we connected through the movies. And over the years, I know now that the warmth of that connection with my family and with the images up on the screen gave me something very precious, because we were experiencing something fundamental together. We were living through the emotional truths on the screen together, often in coded form, these films from the 40s and 50s. Sometimes they're expressed in small things, gestures, glances, reactions between the characters, light, shadow. I mean, we experienced these things that we normally couldn't discuss or wouldn't discuss or even acknowledge in our own lives. And that's actually part of the wonder. So whenever I hear people dismiss movies as fantasy, I make a hard distinction between film and life. I think to myself that it's just a way of avoiding the power of cinema. And of course, it's not life. It's the invocation of life. It's an ongoing dialogue with life. Frank Capra said, "Film is a disease." He went on, but that's enough for now. I caught the disease early on, you know. I used to feel it. They used to take me to the movies all the time. I used to feel it whenever we walked up to the ticket booth, my mother and my father and my brother. You go through the doors and the thick carpet to the past the popcorn stand where it had that wonderful smell, then to the ticket taker. And then sometimes they get these doors would open in the back, and you, there were little windows in it in some of these old theaters, and I could see something magical happening up there on the screen, something special. And as we entered, for me, I think now it was like entering a sacred space, kind of a sanctuary where the living world around me seemed to be recreated and played out. What was it about cinema? What was so special about it? I mean, I think I've discovered some of my own answers to that question a little bit at a time over the years. First of all, there's light. Light is at the beginning of cinema, of course. It's fundamental because it's created with light. And it's still best seen projected in dark rooms where it's the only source of light. But light is also at the beginning of everything. Most creation myths start with darkness, and then the real beginning comes with light, which means the creation of forms, which leads to distinguishing one thing from another and ourselves from the rest of the world, recognizing patterns, similarities, differences, naming things, interpreting the world, metaphors, seeing one thing in light of something else, becoming enlightened. So light is at the core of who we are and how we understand ourselves. And then there's movement. I remember when I was about 5 or 6, somehow I was able to see someone project a 16-millimeter cartoon in a small projector, and I was allowed to look inside the projector, and I saw these little still images passing mechanically through the gate at a very, very steady rate of speed. And in the gate, they were upside down, but they were moving. And on the screen, they came out right side up, moving. At least it was a sensation of movement. But it was really more than that. Something clicked then. Pieces of time. That's how James Stewart, the great actor, defined movies in a conversation with Peter Bogdanovich. That wonder I felt when I saw this, these little figures move. The desire to make images move, the need to capture movement, I mean, seems to be with us 30,000 years ago in the cave paintings of Chauvet, as you can see here in this image, the bison. Appears to have multiple sets of legs. Maybe that was the artist's way of creating the impression of movement. I think this need to recreate movement is a mystical urge. It's an attempt to capture the mystery of who and what we are, and then to think about that, to contemplate that mystery. Which brings us to the boxing cats. Yes, yes, yes. Yes, these are the boxing cats. This appears to be two cats boxing. It was shot in 1894 in Thomas Edison's Black Maria studio that he had in New Jersey. It was actually a little shack. This is one of hundreds of little scenes that he and his team recorded with his kinetograph. It's probably one of the lesser known scenes. There are better known ones of a blacksmith, the heavyweight champion Jim Corbett boxing, you know, Annie Oakley, the great sharpshooter from Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. I mean, at some point somebody had the idea that, you know, two cats boxing apparently is what went on in New Jersey at the time. Don't say anything about now. Okay. Edison, of course, was one of the people who invented film. And there's been a lot of debate about who really invented film. There was Edison, the Lumiere brothers in France, Fries, Green, and R.W. Paul in England. And actually, you can go back to a man named Louis Le Prince, who shot a little home movie in 1888. But then you could go back even further to the motion studies of Edward Muybridge, which were made in the 1870s, 1880s. He would set a number of still cameras side by side, and then he'd trigger them to take photos in succession of people and animals in movement. His employer, Leland Stanford, bet him that all four of a horse's hooves do not leave the ground when the horse is running. But as you can see here, Muybridge won the bet. All four hooves do leave the ground at the same time while the horse is galloping. Does cinema really begin with Muybridge, or should we go all the way back to the cave paintings? In his novel, Joseph and His Brethren, Thomas Mann writes, "The deeper we sound, the further down into the lower world of the past we probe and press, the more do we find that the earliest foundations of humanity, its history and culture, reveal themselves unfathomable." All beginnings are unfathomable. The beginning of human history, the beginning of cinema. Now this film, by the Lumiere brothers in France, is commonly recognized as the first publicly projected film. It was shot in 1895, and when you watch it, it really is 1895. The way they dress, the way they move. It's now, the present, and it's then at the same time. And that's the third aspect of cinema that makes it so uniquely powerful. It's the element of time. Again, pieces of time. When we made the movie Hugo, we went back and tried to recreate that first screening when people were so startled to see this image that they jumped back. They thought the train was going to hit them, you see. And when we studied the Lumiere film, because we had to use the original, we could see right away that it was very different from the Edison films. They weren't, these films that the Lumiere did, they weren't just setting up the camera to record events or scenes. This film is composed. When you study it, you can see how carefully they placed the camera, the thought that went into what was in the frame, what was left out of the frame, the distance between the camera and the train, the height of the camera, the angle of the camera. And what's interesting is that if the camera had been placed even a little bit differently, the audience probably wouldn't have reacted the way they did. So in essence, the Lumières weren't just recording events the way they did in the Edison studio. They were really interpreting reality and telling a story with just one angle. And of course, so was Georges Méliès. Méliès began as a magician, and his pictures were made to be part of his live magic act. He created trick photography, incredible handmade special effects, and in so doing, he sort of remade reality. The screen in his pictures is like opening a magic cabinet of curiosities and wonders. Now, over the years, Lumiere brothers and Méliès have been consistently portrayed as opposites. One film reality, the other film special effects. Of course, this happens all the time. It's a way of simplifying history. But in essence, they were both heading in the same direction. They were just taking different roads. They were taking reality and interpreting it, reshaping it, and trying to find meaning in it. Everything went further. It was taken further with the cut. Who made the first cut from one image to another? Meaning a shift from one vantage point to another, with the viewer understanding that we're still within one continuous action. As far as we know, one of the earliest and most famous examples of a cut from Edwin S. Porter's 1903 milestone film, The Great Train Robbery. Now, even though he cuts from the interior of the car to the exterior, we know we're in one unbroken action. And this film is one of the dozens of one-reel films that D.W. Griffith made in 1912. It's a remarkable film called The Musketeers of Pig Alley, commonly referred to as the first gangster film, and actually it's a great Lower East Side New York street film. Now, if you watch, the gangsters are crossing quite a bit of space before they get to Pig Alley, which is actually a recreation of a famous Jacob Riis photo of Bandit's Roost from the Five Points. But you know, you're not seeing them cross that space on the screen. Yet, you are seeing it. You're seeing it all in your mind's eye. You're inferring it. And this is the fourth aspect of cinema that's so special. That inference, that image in the mind's eye. For me, it's where the obsession began. It's what keeps me going, actually. It never fails to excite me because you take one shot, you put it together with another shot, and you experience a third image in your mind's eye that doesn't really exist in those two other images. The Soviet filmmaker Eisenstein, Sergei Eisenstein, wrote about this, and it was at the heart of all the films he did. And this is what fascinates me, though. It's frustrating sometimes. It's always exciting. Because if you change the timing of the cut, even slightly, by just a few frames or even one frame, then the third image in your mind's eye changes too. And that has been called, appropriately, I believe, film language. Now, in 1916... D.W. Griffith made a picture, an epic, called Intolerance, in part as an act of atonement for the racism in Birth of a Nation. Intolerance ran about 3 hours, but he goes further. He goes further with the idea of the cut. He shifts between four different stories. The first story is the massacre of the Huguenots, and the second story is the Passion of Christ. The third is a spectacle, really, the fall of Babylon. and a fourth story, which was a modern American story set in 1916, the train. Now, at the end of the picture, what Griffith did is that he cut between the different climaxes of these different stories. He cross-cut through time, something that had never really been done before. He tied together images, not for story purposes or narrative purposes, but to illustrate an idea, thesis. In this case, the thesis was that intolerance has existed throughout the ages, and it's always destructive. Now, Eisenstein later wrote about this kind of editing and gave it a name. He called it intellectual montage. For the writers and commentators who were very, very suspicious of movies because, after all, it did start as a Nickelodeon storefront attraction, this was the element that signified film as an art form. But, of course, it already was an art form. That started with Lumiere and Méliès and Porter. This was just another logical step in the development of the language of cinema. But the cinema we're talking about here, Edison, the Lumiere brothers, Méliès, Porter, all the way through Griffith, and all the way through Kubrick, that's really almost gone. It's been overwhelmed by moving images coming at us all the time and absolutely everywhere. I mean, classical cinema, as it's come to be called, kind of feels now like grand opera of Verdi or Puccini, that period. And we're no longer talking about celluloid. That really is a thing of the past. For many film lovers, this is a great sadness and a sense of loss. I certainly feel it myself. I grew up with celluloid and its particular beauty and its idiosyncrasies. But, you know, cinema has always been tied to technological development. And if we spend too much time lamenting what's gone, then we're going to miss the excitement of what's happening now. I mean, everything's wide open. To some, this is a cause for concern. But I think it's an exciting time precisely because we don't know what tomorrow will bring, let alone next week. And we have no choice but to treat all these moving images coming at us as a language. We need to be able to understand what we're seeing and find the tools to sort it all out.
That was an excerpt from Martin Scorsese's National Endowment for the Humanities Jefferson Lecture, which he gave last month at the Kennedy Center. You'll find a link to a video of Scorsese's complete lecture and a slideshow of stills from movies that he mentions at our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is senior engineer Fred Snyder. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yo-Wei Shah. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.